think it was not something that we expected to see, and I think it really speaks to the fiscal hardship that states and plans have experienced in the course of the 21st century. I think two back-to-back recessions. I think as you well know more than I, in budget season we have really hard choices to make, and I think pension debt is sometimes a difficult thing to sell when you have really pressing current needs. It's something that's easy to kick down the road, and I can't speak for every all 50 states, but I suspect that it's just a factor of how hard it is to make the state budget cover all your bases.
President Thiessen?
Thank you. Yeah, it's just it seemed like it's the chart before that was tied to the basically the economic growth or not, right? So when the economy recovered, generally the share of pensions as the pension debt as a share of gross domestic product would go down, and when we hit recessions, it would go up. So what you're saying though is that in reaction to that, so it's not just an investment return issue, which it appeared to be before the 2000s, but states didn't step up with increasing their contributions in the face of the recession. I mean, there are two different things there, and that's the...
Yeah. Ms. Banta.
Madam Chair, Mr. Thiessen, I think what's going on here is the fact that there is this substantial debt in the pension system is a fairly new phenomenon. It's not something that in the past legislatures have had to really factor into their budget negotiations. And as I said, it's a very hard thing. It seems so intangible when you're talking about schools or other competing interests. And I think it's, in retrospect, as I said, it was not something we expected to see, but we could come up with a variety of narratives that kind of speak to how that could happen.
Mm-hmm. Further questions? Ms. Banta or Mr. Dawson, on the slide, page 24, key findings, adopt innovative policies tailored to manage market volatility. Can you give me an example of something like that, please, towards the end there?
Sure. Yeah. I think... Mr. Wiley will probably be talking about that at some length after we're finished here. But I think there are states that have contribution policies that are designed to guarantee retirement security for workers while at the same time not subjecting taxpayers to wildly growing expenses. As I said, I think Wisconsin has a particularly interesting benefit structure. I know South Dakota has spent a lot of time over the last several years enacting policies that do just that. So, the COLAs, or as Wisconsin calls them, the dividends, can increase and decrease as the market performs or does not perform in a place like Wisconsin. Another way that things can change, as I said before, is how contributions are determined, mm-hmm. how much the state budget is putting into the system under different economic scenarios, whether there's a floor. Mm-hmm. I think in the case of South Carolina, the floor is potentially a less controversial benefit structure that, there's a lot of predictability there, and it also protects you, builds up your asset levels for downturns. It's probably more expensive, though. Mm-hmm. So, in the short term, I should say, on any given budget. But those are the kinds of examples, and we'd be happy to share with you others from across the 50 states, if you're interested.
That'd be great. Thank you. Further questions for Ms. Banta? Great. I'm sorry. Representative Bogle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you know, the charts on 19 and 21 dealing with cash flow, and this has been a big concern of mine because being in somewhat of a risk management business myself, the concern is always that as we tend to have the assets deplete that are going to supply the cash flow, we tend to take more risk, and that was borne out in one of the first slides you showed. I'm curious how states, if you're aware of states that are really looking at this, because you can really get into a death spiral really quick here, because once those assets start to deplete, if indeed you're inclined to take more risk to poop up the returns and it doesn't happen, now you've doubled down and really caused it to happen quicker. Are you familiar with states that have put in place a policy that avoids that, because it's a tendency that we all have?
Ms. Banta or Mr. Dawson?
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel, I think Pennsylvania is an example that comes to mind. It's probably not the example you're looking for, in that they don't have a contribution, they don't have a long-term contribution policy that prevented that situation. But what they did do is, once they recognized that they were in some risk of financial distress, they basically took their medicine and came up with a pretty substantial contribution increase over a period of years to try and mitigate the dynamic that you're describing. And so one of the reasons that the graph that I showed with their costs being quite high, one of the reasons that is because they had, for many years, hadn't made the proper contribution levels, and now they're having to pay for that. So that's one example that comes to mind. But I should have said at the outset, there's no one size fits all. I think every state is different, and I think that there are lots of tools in the toolkit. It's just a matter of what is most appropriate for the state of Minnesota and what the state has an appetite for. And it's just different. It's, as you know, it's a problem that has many tentacles, and there's just lots of ways to approach it. I know that's not a very satisfying answer.
Further questions? Mr. Dawson, do you have anything you'd like to share? Or?
No, I don't. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Susan covered it pretty well. I would reiterate that no one-size-fits-all solution is very accurate. We've seen all sorts of interesting things from all sorts of states, especially in the past 10 years or so, with states trying to grapple with this problem. New plan designs have been adopted. States have thought about selling assets to help deal with the debt that's already on the books. Jacksonville recently came up with a new sales tax and marked that to help pay down their debt, while also adopting a completely different plan design that they felt like addressed the risk that the city was facing a little bit better. So we've seen many, many different things, and like Susan said, we're happy to follow up and provide you guys with whatever examples we've seen across the 50 states, but there have been many, many different various solutions to these problems.
Okay. Thank you. I know Senator Limber had to step out for a second. I'm not sure if you got an answer, or if you were here for the answer of why our assumed rate of return was where that sits on the average. It's a little above average. Is that correct?
Yes.
6.5 to 7 is where a lot of states have set, but can you fill in the blanks on that as far as how other states have dropped that assumed rate down, and if you'd like to give your opinion on our 2017 reform package and going forward with that, I'd appreciate that too.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. As I said earlier, I think after much study on the issue, we kind of came out at a 50 percentile rate of return of 6.4%. That analysis was done before the last fiscal year returns were logged, but I think we feel pretty good about the range of 6.4 to 7% as kind of a an average, a reasonable average expected return. I think, but to your point, Madam Chair, I think the average is closer to 7.5%. We have seen substantial movement, and by substantial, I mean many states as opposed to large differences, changing their rates, moving them slowly down. I can provide you with a list of who's done what. CalPERS is the one that comes to mind. They have kind of a plan of lowering it over time that they've enacted. So it's just, you know, it's just automatically going to happen. That's one way to try and bite it off little by little. If you're interested in lowering it to 7.5, but you don't feel like you can get there, you can maybe do it over 2 years. Some states have taken that approach. But I think lowering it from 8, my personal opinion is 8% is perhaps a little high.
Mm-hmm. Our plan is to lower it to 7.5% going forward.
Senator Limmer, question? You have that look. I know that
I
look.
I have that look. I'm sure oftentimes when we look at rate of returns, somehow in the conversation with those who are the beneficiaries of a pension, they're hoping that as a rate of return would go up, their rate of a cost of living allowance change or an increase to their pension benefit would increase also. And in a perfect world, why not raise it to the same rate of return that's coming in? And I think just being prudent in a volatile world that we live in, we wouldn't want to have that. You always want to bring in a little bit more and spend a little less, because it's not just the obligation to the present beneficiaries, but it's also the obligation. And I'm using the word obligation even though I raised it before. The obligation is to those that are now working, contributing to a pension, and leave something on the plate for them when they get to that time. And so one can't live in a pension world without the other, and so you need to have a correct assumption when it comes to computing where we might be going with a rate of return. And I remember when many years ago you and I were having a discussion on the Senate floor about an 8% rate of return, and sure enough, we did come in with that. I think we even came in a little higher, but it's always been my concern to watch the rate of return as well as the COLA number, because that's going to affect everything. Mm-hmm. And then the backdrop is how volatile is the marketplace, or what are the things that we can't control that are going to affect any of these rates of return. Something could happen in the Mideast and suddenly the price of oil goes sky high, all because one second lieutenant in a banana belt country lights off a missile somewhere, and all of a sudden it triggers a whole avalanche of consequences that change the world market very, very quickly, overnight. Mm-hmm. And so conservative estimates I like better. Mm-hmm. And not to have a pie in the sky type perspective in it. And I'm not claiming this is. Mm-hmm. We just need to analyze carefully.
Right. Thank you, Senator Limburg. And it says here in their questions and concerns, in Colorado, a stress analysis was conducted as part of a mandatory report on the effectiveness of a prior reform and raised important questions about whether the changes would be sufficient in the event of another economic downturn. And that's something we should probably take a look at going forward.
Further questions? Yeah, Representative Vogel.
Madam Chair, thank you. And the rate discussion brings to mind one of the reasons that I thought it would be so valuable to do something like this is because we don't know what the rates will be. And what this is really looking at is all of the variables put together, as I had said. And I think that's – we don't know what they're going to be. We're going to make some projections, but we're also going to have to do that in a threshold of higher and lower. And like I said before, my biggest fear is that we put this thing into a death spiral by not having enough assets to pay out the benefits that we're legally obligated to do. And then the decision is made to take a little more risk in the loan the investment portfolio because you have to make up that difference. And the key with doing this now is constantly feeding us information. If we do this on a continuing basis, we're continually updated with new information that helps us make better decisions. And the one thing that we can control, which is difficult, is the contribution level. We can't control the investment. So, therefore, that's what I really saw the value here was having the information that this gives us so that we can make informed decisions on an ongoing basis so that we don't get into a point where we're forced to make decisions that we probably shouldn't, and we actually make it worse rather than better because we can't possibly take enough out of the budget and we're guessing that the investment returns are going to go our way, and that's usually when they don't. So, I'm so happy that they were willing to come, and I'd really encourage us to look seriously at doing this because what we need is information to manage this thing as well as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Vogel, and we will continue this discussion. I think it's great, too. Again, thank you for you bringing this up, and I'm very, very happy that you, too, made the distance over here. Thank you so much. You are a wonderful source of information for us all to use in various areas, too, but especially in the world of pensions where we sometimes it's a learning curve. It's like this.
Madam Chair, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Ms. Banta, Mr. Dawson. Thank you very much. And with that, we are going to be calling up Mr. Robert Wiley, the Executive Director of the South Dakota Retirement System.
Thank you.
Welcome, Mr. Wiley.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
We certainly can.
I'm Rob Wiley, the Executive Director at the South Dakota Retirement System. Thank you for the opportunity to come and visit with you today. It is great to come and visit a neighbor and get a chance to talk about pensions. It's for some of us geeks, that sounds like kind of almost a pretty wonderful thing. So I'm glad to be here. I'd like to tell you about what we're doing in South Dakota, talk about the perspective of how we go about managing the dollars of the South Dakota retirement system and the generational design that we have recently worked on. It's really fit to South Dakota. The demographics of South Dakota, the population of South Dakota. There are features in it that may be helpful to others, but really know that this was fashioned for South Dakota. I have to go back to one of the concluding things that Susan and Tim said, and I can't tell you how true I believe that is. There is no single answer that fits for every state, for every organization. Unfortunately, it leaves you with the tough choices, the hard decisions. The important things are to listen to everyone that can share things with you and try and find the best solution for you. And know that I commend you for bringing the group together here and talking about it, but there isn't a single silver bullet for any of this. And I can't. I wished I could tell you something different, but there just isn't one. So. Let me jump right into this. I realize that we're probably running a little bit behind for you, but let me jump into the presentation.
Mr. Wiley, you just take your time. Thank you. We're good.
Thank you. South Dakota Retirement. SDRS is why I refer to it in several of your things here, and that's what we're talking about. Is a hybrid defined benefit plan covering essentially all South Dakota public employees. The word hybrid might even be a misnomer here. What the real word is actually flexible. We tried to add in the last few years here certain features that allow the plan to move with the marketplace. There are three primary tenets in our making these changes and going forward. The first is one that looks very familiar to you. That is, SDRS operates within the resources provided by fixed statutory member and employer contribution rates. We live within what is in the statute, and that's part of how we manage our plan. The second part is that with the recent changes made, we have significant variable features that adjust benefits to changing marketplace and plan experience. This feature was all about sustainability, making sure that we can react to whatever happens in the marketplace. It maybe can't get us all the way to a situation like the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, but it covers us in most circumstances, and then we'll have to react when the time comes for something exceptional. And then the other thing that we do, it's a little different than maybe most, is that we've established in statute funding thresholds that if they are crossed, we have to make recommendations for corrective action. And for all practical purpose, that is for benefit reductions. Now, we've looked at this in the past as not being a reduction in a benefit, but a slowing in the growth of benefits. That discipline exists for the plan. It has for the last 40 years that employees, employers, stakeholders all know that there are thresholds that if we cross, we have to take action to bring that plan back into what we consider alignment. So as a result, it's a fixed budget for retirement benefits, automatically adjusting benefit features and specific measures that dictate when corrective action would have to be taken. Our three primary pieces that have been critical in our maintaining our funded status. 2017, we were 100% funded. We have been 100% funded in 27 in the last 32 years. One of the documents that I did forward to Susan was what was called the perspective on management of the South Dakota retirement system. I do not know if that went out to the group or not, but the next two pages highlight features that we think are important to a plan and how they establish their plan and how they run their plan. First and foremost, we completely support defined benefits. We believe that is the most efficient, advantageous design for SDRS members, employers, and taxpayers. The shared longevity, the shared risk, the shared the income of all sorts is shared in that defined benefit plan. It is that is so valuable to our members in South Dakota. With that said, we also think flexible features that combine advantages of those defined benefits with the advantages of defined contribution plan are important to the overall sustainability of a plan, and it also gives us the opportunity to provide for an equity type look between both career and non-career people. We in the past have struggled a little bit with the benefits that grow and accrue to a person who, say, has 10 years of service as a public employee. In the past, sometime in the past, all we did was give them their money back and earnings on their money. They didn't share in the share of the employer contributions. We've moved to try and provide that share also to these employees, that it is a feature that's like a defined contribution plan, but it fits into this defined benefit plan. Variable benefits based on affordability. It's all about sustainability. And for us, the COLA was the primary product for providing for that flexibility. We believe that we should have specific benefit objectives and stay within those objectives. We need to make sure that we provide an adequate retirement based on a fair return for those individuals, but we also don't think we should make it excessive. We try to replace 55% of the income of a career employee, and we consider that career employee to be 30 years of service. We also recommend that that between Social Security and personal retirement savings, they should be shooting for a goal of 85% of income. Now, that one is, there's a certain amount of personal in that, and I should note that everyone in South Dakota that's in the public arena is in Social Security. So you may not have everyone in your state in Social Security where we do. And And then the last point here is provisions and practices that result in higher than intended inflated benefits should be avoided. Let me move on to a second page here. If I get this, there we go. Each state is going to be different in how they approach the actual responsibilities and management that come to the Board of Trustees. In South Dakota, we really expect the Board of Trustees to be fiduciaries. We expect the Board of Trustees to be in a position that they have the expertise and the knowledge that they can be the driver behind benefit improvements, behind funding policy, and as a fiduciary, we want the Board of Trustees to lead the discussion on pensions. As I told you earlier, we have fixed contributions. We've been fixed contributions since we began in 1974. Variable contributions may require significant and unpredictable higher costs. We don't have the budget. I can't go to my legislature and ask them for additional dollars in the form of contributions. That's just not in our game plan. It just won't happen. So we live within that, and we have to adjust our plan benefit structure to maintain that allowance to stay within those framework of those limited contributions. And I would note to you that over time, as these plans have matured, contribution increases alone, it will be difficult for plans that are mature to be able to deal with funding issues with just contributions. As we've grown, our plans have matured. If you think of where you're at today compared to what you were 15 years ago, contributions probably made up a significant amount of what would be the assets at that time. Today, your contribution level is small compared to the size of the plan, and so it has really meant the mature plan has become more difficult to deal with when there are changes. It can't, in most cases, can't just be a contribution issue. Again, our funding policy provides for a minimum funding standards. It dictates that when we have a situation like a 2009 and 8 and 9, that we have to come in and make adjustments. We had to go in 2017 and make adjustments to look at maintaining our funded status. A couple of these last issues also...
Representative Murphy.
Would you tell us a little more about what you mean by a mature plan?
Mr. Riley.
Chair.
Mr. Riley.
As plans have grown, and for us when we look at it, and everyone's going to look at it a little bit differently, it's a measure of size. But when an actuary would look at it, they would look at it as how much of your liability is accrued to active benefits. As a plan grows in age, more of the benefits accruing to that plan are already in pay status. Once you get past 40% of what would be the overall liability in pay status, you're probably talking about a pretty mature plan in that so much of the cost is in individuals that are not contributing anymore. And I think that's maybe the best way I can say it, that it's more benefits payable immediately.
Representative Murphy.
And Chair, sir, then it's because people are living longer.
Mr. Riley.
Yes, that is one of the factors, one of the main factors, but also it's the maturity of the plan. Depending on your circumstance, and I don't know when the Minnesota plan started, but over time the numbers have grown in the size of the plan. There's more people in the plans today than there were 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And so it just the sheer size in it and then the growing of the demographic, the aging of the demographic.
Mr. Riley, you said something about adjustments must be made to meet the minimum funding standards. What did you do? Just give me a couple ideas. What you did recently.
Yes. Recently, we went in and looked at what we were paying as a COLA. And And that was based on, and this is going back to Susan's discussion, is an experience study that included stochastic modeling and looking at where we thought we needed to be going forward, and particularly as it related to the investment return assumption. By lowering that assumption, we had some situations that caused us to be out of balance. We passed those thresholds, and we went in and adjusted the COLA to a more flexible COLA to make sure that we remained in actuarial balance. That is, the dollars coming in the form of contributions met the growing of the liabilities based on those new scenarios.
Thank you.
So these last two bullets on this page are all about that stress testing, that risk management that you heard about in the prior conversation, we think are critical to the overall sustainability of a plan.
And what is your discount rate, Mr. Wiley?
6.5.
Senator Frantz.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you very much, Mr. Wiley. I know you're as proud of your public employees as we are here in Minnesota. My concern is predictability. So when we have public employees come to serve the state of Minnesota, I hope you'd agree with me, it's easier for them to plan for retirement if they have predictable benefits. So I see in your presentation variable benefits, adjust benefits. You're asking the public employees of South Dakota to share in the risk a little bit of the rate of return. Fair enough?
Mr. Wiley.
Fair enough. It is, and what I would want to make sure I make known to you is that we've never actually cut a benefit. It's slowing down the growth of benefits that we have seen as the way to approach this issue.
Senator Frantz.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Wiley. My question is, when we recruit public employees in Minnesota, we tell them you can count on retirement benefits. Do you see any effect of the flexibility that you're talking about in your plan on your ability to recruit people to these professions? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Wiley.
Actually, we get feedback as much that thank you for making sure this benefit is secure going forward. I'm not giving up any dollars today. It's not growing as fast tomorrow, but thank you for making sure it's here 20 years from now or 30 years from now. My retirees, amazing as it may seem, have came back and saw sustainability as being critical. They look at Social Security and say, I'm not sure it's going to be there. But they look at this and say, you guys are doing the proactive things to make these things happen, to keep that funding level up without lowering my benefit. That's what I want. We actually get more positive things on that than negative.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wiley, my assumption would be, since you're 100% funded, that you don't have a deficit to make up. In other words, you're only accruing basically as an expense the current benefit rather than both the current and trying to make up a deficit from the past?
Mr. Wiley?
That is true. We do not have an unfunded liability.
Okay. Representative Vogel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the reason I bring that up is, as I had gone through that Virginia stress plan, and I'm thinking it's not uncommon that the current benefit that's being accrued is nearly matched in a lot of cases by making up the deficit. And I would assume that is one of the reasons, and maybe Mr. Wiley could answer, why they can keep this relatively constant, because where a lot of states have to be making up and amortizing that deficit over the next 20 or 30 years and then re-amortizing it every once in a while, that's been growing and therefore really impedes what you have to put in.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wiley?
I'm not going to tell you that I have surveyed each group, but I think your statement is probably true for those plans that have a significant underfunding. Obviously, that's had a big impact on their contribution rates.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Mr. Wiley. Continue.
And just, again, one last comment on this last slide here is risk measurements are critical. The prior group showed you actuarial standards 51, which will be coming out. We're all right now trying to figure out exactly what will be the actuary's efforts in that area, and I think it's something that all of us in the industry are working towards improving our understanding of risk, whether it be in the form of stress testing. And I actually have a couple slides at the end here that show you a little bit about what we're doing on some of our preliminary on what we're doing on risk. Down to what's happened in South Dakota in the last couple of years. 2016, we went in and said we need to be more forward-looking in this plan. There are certain things about our plan that, in essence, subsidize certain types of actions and that were involved in for some of the people in the plan. Some of those actions in the form of subsidies meant we were less competitive in other areas. We came in 16 and said, okay, let's try and look forward to what a new employee would want to see, what would work for them, how a career might look for them. And we effectively went in and said, you know what? Their mortality has changed. We're going to live a little longer. So we're going to increase the normal retirement age by 2 years and all of the earlier retirements. But at the same time, we're going to increase the multiplier because we know they're here a little bit longer. That money grows a little longer. And at the same time, those are offsetting a little bit. Plus, we've gone in and taken out what would be the subsidies for early retirement as we were actually not discounting. You were getting paid longer, but we weren't discounting the amount of the benefit. Think of Social Security. If you go out before age 66 right now and 67 coming, you're decreased by a certain amount depending on your age when you're out. Actually taking a page out of their playbook and approach it that way. So we're not subsidizing someone to go out early. We ended up recognizing that there were certain compensation loopholes that were happening out there that some could spike their benefit a little bit at the end of their career, and so we kind of cleaned up some of those things. It changed our look going forward for new employees after 17. It's what's called the generational design for us, and it adds with that, because of the savings for taking out those subsidies, we could add a piece that was a part of the contributions that was made on behalf of each member, in this case right now 1.5%, that would go into an account earning the amount that is earned in the plan each year, and that would grow alongside their defined benefit plan. We've recognized particularly the cost of health care in retirement, and that we needed a wealth piece to go along with that foundation piece of the defined benefit plan. So the two together would provide those kinds of features, one that stayed with you every time in a monthly check, the other that grew during your career to support those other things that we all know we need in retirement, whatever those would be for each individual. So that was the effort of 2016. In many cases, it's been portrayed as a little bit of a design that might be accepted by the millennial group, in that they have both the security of the defined benefit and the growth in the variable retirement account to go together to provide their future benefit. Then at the same time, next year, 17, we went in and did the adjustment to the COLA that effectively gave it a wider spread for what it would be, depending on the CPI and how well your plan was funded. It could go up to 3.5%. It had only gone up to 3.1% in the past, but it could also fall depending on what the CPI was. We ran into a situation between 2010 and 2017 where we paid a COLA that was, in general, well in excess of the CPI. And we ended up running up a certain amount of plan costs that were above the board's goal. We needed to come back and relook at that and be proactive in getting that COLA back in alignment with where it fit better in what were the costs of retirement. It was, again, it was one of those things that might be questioned, and at the same time, the feedback that we got from our retirees was, we need to do what will make this plan sustainable. Means maybe I don't get a whole 3% each year, but it also doesn't put me in a situation that 20 years down the way, I'll be uncertain whether I get a check. And so that's the kind of thoughts that we've approached here, and we've had really great reception from those that were in the benefit stream. So those are the two big changes that we did in the last couple years. Let me jump forward.
Mr. Wiley?
Yes.
Did you do a mortality study, or did you just come up with a two-year advancement on the retirement age?
We did a full study and evaluated the mortality tables were available at the time. Interestingly enough, at the time that we did this, and it's maybe too technical here, but we thought that the actuarial standard board had made a mistake in one of their mortality tables, and they have now rolled that back just slightly. And so we ended up following what was the rolled back version instead of what was the original version in 14.
Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that same issue, did you actually move your retirement age? What did you move it by 2 years? It's not just the assumptions. It's you move the age, kind of the benefit age. Can you tell me what you moved it from and to?
Yes. Mr. Wiley?
Now, this is for the new hires, 17 and after. So one who was in the foundation group was changed. We moved it from 65 normal retirement age to 67, match up with Social Security. Obviously 66 right now for Social Security, but by the time any of these people get there, it'll be 67 or maybe more than that.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Does your board of trustees do the investing also, or is somebody else do the different board do the investments?
Mr.
South
Wiley.
Dakota is just exactly like Minnesota. We have two separate boards, an investment board and also retirement board. Ours is the only retirement board. We consolidate all of the groups, and then the investments are handled with another group. We do a cross. And that I sit on the investment board, and the state investment officer sits on the retirement board. And so it is such an important relationship. We have that cross, and it's been a terrific relationship. I like the idea of a separate board for retirement and a separate board for investments.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Thiessen.
And just to follow up on that and kind of build on the last discussion, I mean, part of that is because your investment board is not going to change. They're not going to invest in riskier stuff because there's a deficit. They're going to invest to hit the percentage, the 7.5 or 6.5. And so the allocation is to hit the 6.5, right? They're not going to look at the pension deficit, which you don't have, fortunately. Would that be the right analysis? And because they are separate boards?
Mr. Wiley.
Yes. You know, I think there's a little bit of an assumption sometimes that they're all together, but really the investment board needs to build their own expectations, build their own designs, have their own expected returns, have their own likelihoods of achieving what they achieve. I do have a slide at the end here, if we get to it, that I'd like to show you, because it's exactly that situation. It separates the investment, separates the retirement, and those objectives of each of those need to be independent.
Representative Thiessen?
And a totally unrelated question, but is that variable benefit, is that an annuity they get paid out, or do people get a lump sum, or do they have a choice?
They have a choice.
Mr. Wiley?
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Choice.
Representative Murphy or Representative Vogel? No? Gosh, I thought I was getting so good at knowing when somebody wanted to talk. No, I stumbled. Mr. Wiley, our para group has been working on the COLA varying with the CPI, and was that your idea, or did you come up with, are there other states doing that work with?
There are a certain number of states that do base their COLA on CPI. A variation on ours is probably a little bit different in that, because of the way we have designed it, if we have to modify the COLA because we weren't fully funded, then we would use that restricted COLA forward instead of what is in most cases a COLA that is defined in their assumptions in our assumptions, we provide for flexibility even okay. in the assumption.
Okay.
Let me touch just a couple things on our overall funding policy. We do strive to be 100% funded. We expect to not have unfunded liabilities, and we expect our contribution rate to be adequate to pay all of those required contributions. We do not consider benefit improvements unless we are 120% funded or greater. And even at that, we would not do a funding improve or benefit improvement unless after the improvement we are still 120% funded.
Mr. Wiley, some of us do not have the funding objectives, so members that there's some that do and some that don't, but we're all good. Read them.
Sorry.
Thank you. That's okay. No problem.
It was, I jumped over the page that said appendix in case that was on there.
Right. We're on the management policies. Uh-huh.
And then if we have to do corrective action, it was because we were less than 100% funded or that our contributions were not adequate to pay what were the actuarially determined contributions. Those are the thresholds to require our action. See if I can get myself back here. I don't want to spend much time on this, but we've talked about the generational benefit quite a bit. It was all about sustainability. No change in contributions or costs. We need to meet the benefit goals that we talked about before. 55% of income is what we're trying to replace for a career employee. We want to make sure that the new employees are not subsidizing the former employees or vice versa. We want to make sure that it maintains our defined benefit structure. We want to eliminate or limit any subsidies. And the added benefit feature, that's a variable retirement account, should not create a fixed liability. If you increase your formula, that grows every year no matter what happens with the investment performance. If you do it in the form of a variable account, you can flex that growth in liability to the growth in the assets. It's a subtle difference, but it provides a certain amount of protection for a plan. And actually, in our case, we also looked at workforce needs by our employers in setting up this account, this new generational design. We were having a lot of people taking early retirement, and we didn't have anybody to replace them in some places. And so we ended up scuttling those early retirement incentives going forward, but it'll take some time to get through. But we saw that as maybe being contrary to what the employers were trying to do in their workforce.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Wiley?
Yes.
You said you meet the income replacement goal of 55% of income. How did you derive that? Is that something from other states, or is that something that pension
I think many states have gone in and spent a certain amount of time trying to define what was the right amount or expectation they should have of the plan. We spent a lot of time over the years trying to define both what was a career employee. In all honesty, you have a sensitivity. We had a sensitivity that we're not trying to replace 50% of income for a person who has 10 years of service. We needed to find a place to say, this is what we think is a career, and this is what we think is appropriate for replacing. And we looked at that not just on our own, but also in conjunction with Social Security and what we think is personal savings. And likewise, we looked at it on what should be an expectation for a plan. We shouldn't expect the plan to provide 100% income replacement. That's not, in all honesty, my board didn't consider that good public policy. To pay as much in retirement as you may have been paid while you're working, particularly when you consider that you wouldn't be paying Social Security and you wouldn't be paying your retirement benefit contributions. So we really came down to looking at what we think was the right place. And there's a certain amount of studies out that talk about what kind of income. I think you see anywhere from 70 to 85% as being the numbers that you see out in the industry lots of times of what will maintain your standard of living in retirement?
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wiley, going back to page 4, that was the reference to eliminated subsidies. And on that same line, you eliminated subsidies for early retirement. Could you tell me how you eliminated the subsidies for spousal benefits?
Yes.
Mr. Wiley.
When we originally set up the plan, we put in the original assumption that almost every member of SDRS was married. And so when we originally priced the design, we included it as a joint and survivor benefit without a single life benefit as an option. And at this point, what we did is we went in and offered the option and priced it in such a way that you would get the regular lifetime benefit, but we wouldn't pay, in essence, a supplemental spouse benefit unless there was a corresponding reduction. The benefit itself was priced as assuming a joint and survivor, and so for a person who was single at retirement, they effectively were being treated as though they were married, as though there would be a spousal benefit. Did I answer your question fully?
Yeah.
The page that you have up is page 8 here, and we've actually talked about virtually everything on this page. But let me touch on just one item down here that I should make note of. Down under the termination benefits, and it's just because it's been called to my attention, South Dakota does have a deferred vested benefit. That is, we do index our termination benefits. This is all about an idea that we include as though you had a COLA on your salary from the time that you terminated to the time that you retired, that we wanted a limited incentive for people to, instead of taking their money and running, we wanted them to stay with the system. And it doesn't happen. We still have lots of people refund. But for someone who is near retirement, say they're 50 years old, we don't want them to feel like they lose value in their benefit because of the time value of money. The COLA increase would go on top of their salary, and so they would, in essence, maintain a certain amount of what would be the purchasing power that would have gone with their benefit that stopped at the time that they terminated. And that's probably the only thing we haven't touched on this page. And let me go forward to just the next two pages show you the COLA process, and we've talked quite a bit about that, and we can come back to that if you have questions. But let me go to the last two slides and just give you a little bit of the heads up of what we're looking at. And this is about risk management here. When we go into this each meeting, we go in with our Board of Trustees, and we say, here's where we were at the end of last year. Here's what the earnings have been since that time. If we continue on this pace, this is what we'll be able to pay in a COLA. This is what we would be able to do, what we'd pay in a COLA to be able to maintain 100% funded, that portion of what we've talked about in the COLA already. And then on the last page, and this goes back again to stress testing and risk measurement. If you have a plan and you have limited variability in that plan, that is, when the actuary goes in and calculates the actuarially determined contribution, they go in and say, okay, here's the span of possible returns that might happen and how you would come out, and it's a pretty broad thing, a lot like a bell curve. In fact, if you go back to your geometry from high school or middle school or wherever they teach it now, bell curve is a fairly prevalent thing. The middle is the expected return, and then the likelihood of returns around it. Well, that's the mean and the standard deviation that determines that. That's a form of stress testing, and what we've done here is we've plugged in our expected return from our investment shop and the standard deviation around that. And by having flexible benefits, that COLA that moves, it gives us protection so we're not in that situation where it's just 50-50. If we earn above it, we maintain our status. If we earn below it, we deplete. And so by having the flexible COLA, it gives you some range of flexibility that protects you, not in all circumstances, 20%, but it is designed to protect you in some of those situations. Now, there virtually aren't plans that are that 50-50 anymore. Every plan has flexibility features, and so that's too simplistic to say that. And this is maybe even too simplistic to do this compared to a stochastic study or some of the broader pictures. But this is a way that my board stays on top of what's the likelihood of them needing to take any action in the coming years. This is just 1 year right here. We do this modeling for a number of, you know, we can extend that modeling out under a much longer term. But I wanted to give you that just to be able to see that there are some things that we can do. I would expect on the actuarial standards of practice 51, some more of these kinds of things would be stuff that every board will have to look at. And with that, I'm to a place that I would be happy to answer questions or go back and cover anything that's already been here.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Wiley, how much of your plan or your plan changes have to be approved by your legislature? Because I understand, don't you only meet every other year, the legislature?
Mr. Wiley.
May I?
Mr. Wiley.
Mm-hmm. It's Nebraska, or maybe North Dakota. It's every other year. We meet every year.
Oh, you meet every year. It's North Dakota, yeah.
And everything that's in these benefit structures that you saw discussed here has to go through the legislature. The board makes the assumptions. The board sets the assumptions. It's all of the actual benefit features have to be handled through statute.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
That includes any changes in COLA that you make?
Mr. Wiley.
The structure of the COLA is in statute, but the specifics of determining 2% this year or 2.5 or 1.5 is not a statutory. It's statutory in structure, but not
right.
in calculation.
Set up the system, right.
Yeah.
Then you calculate it. Okay, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Wiley, how many plans does your board make their rules for?
Mr. Wiley.
South Dakota Retirement System is a consolidated plan. Literally every public employee but a couple of plans that were closed off now or frozen in the state, everybody is with us. We're it. And it's all consolidated really into one plan. We have features that are separate for public safety members and also for judicial members, but they all wrap into the whole of this process.
Thank you. Mr. Wiley, I stepped out. Did you go over your contribution rates somewhere?
I did not. 6% and 6%. 6% employee, 6% employer. For 95% of the memberships, our general members, 8% and 8% for our public safety, and 9% and 9% for the judicial. Each of these groups have a slightly different formula depending on prior and after, but the public safety have slightly more than 2% as their formula. Ours is our new generational is 1.8, and judicial is more like 3% is per year is their COLA, or excuse me, their formula.
Representative Vogel, did you have a comment? Are you sure you don't have a comment? I thought, yeah. Senator Limmer.
Thank you. On that last description, the 6 and 6, 8 and 8, does that also include a withdrawal for Social Security?
Mr. Wiley.
All of our folks are in Social Security, so that would all be above those rates. If you were a teacher, you'd have 6% contribution on your behalf for SDRS, and your employer would match that. Likewise, Social Security, 6.2 and 6.2 employee and employer for Social Security. So there's a combined feature there.
Super. Thank you so much, Mr. Wiley, for
my
coming
pleasure.
Up.
I'm,
really appreciate it.
Happy to assist in any way.
Absolutely.
I'm connected to the directors from Minnesota here, and so if you need to get in touch with me, you can certainly connect through them, and I'd be happy to help anyway.
Oh, thank you. Well, we're all in it together, and we're neighbors, and and it's the snow is starting to subside, so hopefully you'll get home safely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any comments, questions, members? If I could just, Senator Sundjum.
Madam Chair, I just want to compliment you as chair or whoever else needs to be thanked, because I think this meeting has been particularly good. It's always good to find out what's going on in other places. And
mm-hmm.
I've not been on this commission just a few months, but I don't know if this is past practice or not, but I just thought this was very good.
Well, thank you, Senator Sundjum, and Representative Vogel is to be thanked also. But pensions rocks, I'm telling you. Representative Thiessen, you got to laugh now. Come on. Oh, that's right. You're sick. That's right. And Senator French, you're going to love it. I'm telling you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I've been sitting here for a year now trying to be a studious member of the Pension Commission, but it took a kid from South Dakota to explain it.
Ouch!
And being born from South Dakota myself, I can understand how easy it is now.
Okay, we're going to end this real quickly now. Members, just to recap again, we're going to meet, we're going to start meeting every Tuesday just for a couple, about a month. Next week, a day before forecast, we're going to go over the review of the 2017 bill that we had that passed out before, not what was sent to the governor, but the original pension bill. We're going to have testimony from the plans and public testimony. And we are going to be addressing any issues that our constituents or issues that need to be taken care of that are non-controversial. I want to make this bill as simple and as easy as possible. We're on March 6th, we're going to do the changes to the bill and the edits. And then on March 13th, we're going to have a vote on the bill with public testimony again. We will be, I'll be bringing dinner so you guys can come. We're going to start at, 5:30. I haven't decided on that. So again, on March 13th, we'll vote the bill out. And then we're going to have one more hearing on March 20th. And then with that, hopefully we'll just continue on with more pension, but it won't be the big pension bill. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Thiessen.
Yeah, so just to let our members know, so they need to get their bills in to be heard by March 6th, you said? The individual bills?
Yes, and I sent that out to on the Senate side. Hopefully the House has gotten that memo. Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair, just to clarify that, normally we build a bill, a committee bill, and by offering amendments and then adopting them. So instead we're doing the reverse where you will have a chair's bill, and that's fine. And then we, if there's something we don't agree of, we don't have consensus on, then we have to have a motion to pull it out.
Right. Thank you, Senator Pappas, for clarifying that. Mm-hmm. Because of the short timeline, because everything is condensed, and the importance of getting this bill done, I felt it was prudent to just go ahead and build this pension bill. That is going to be very similar. There's going to be some good changes to it, nothing that is going to cause any dire or any problems. But we do need to discuss those changes, and we will have that opportunity to peel out what you're not comfortable with.
Okay.
Further questions on that?
Thank you.
Great. With that, again, thank you, members. Thank you, everybody here, and thank you for our guest. The motion or the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.